I want to look back, because in order to move forward with reason and with goodness, we have to look back and see what's happened before us before we can go forward. And so I want to look back over the Roman Catholic Church in this great land and trace a few of the things which have been of great importance to all of us. Now, when a priest is ordained, at any rate in the country of Spain, where I was ordained, it is the custom that a priest must have completely new vestments. It's rather like the social custom, not a religious one. It's rather like the custom that concerns a bride when she gets married. I believe a bride is supposed to wear something old, something new, something, I forget what it is, and something blue. Well, a priest in Spain, when he's ordained, is expected to wear completely new vestments that nobody has ever worn before. It's a sort of a social convention. Everything must be new, even the alb and the amus and this girdle around the waist. All of those things must be new. I was ordained, as I think you know, late in life, on May the 1st, 1967. And I was in Seville in Spain, where I had been studying in the seminary. And so, about 3 weeks before my ordination, I went to the rector of the seminary and asked his advice on where to get some new vestments made. Good ones, at a reasonable price. And he directed me to a certain convent in the oldest part of Seville. So I went down to this convent, and I discovered that it was a convent that was enclosed. That is, it had clausura, as it's called. A convent that is enclosed means one in which the nuns never come out. They stay behind bars, as it were, as voluntary prisoners of the Lord. And so I went to this convent, which I noticed was very ancient and very complex, and I rang the bell. And a little slot about this thing opened. And I saw an eye looking out at me. And it seemed to me that that eye had a rather hostile look about it. I'm always a bit frightened when I see an eye looking through a hole at me. You never quite know what's there on the other side. So the nun on the other side, I assumed it was a nun, she said, "Will you state your business, please?" That frightened me a little bit more. So I said, "Well, sister, I've come to have some vestments made. I'm going to be ordained priest in 3 weeks' time." And I could see the eye look even more hostile and suspicious. The eye looked at my gray hair. And I imagined that the ear listened to my foreign accent, because we were speaking Spanish. But what seemed to me rather reluctantly, she opened the door and admitted me. And there were bars intersected the opening. She was on one side and I was on the other. So I told her, I said, "Sister, I'm a lay vocation. And I said, I'm being ordained in 3 weeks and I want some new vestments, white, for ordination." So she said, "I'll go get the Mother Superior." So a very fine-looking nun came and, with a great smile on her face, greeted me and said, "Father, I've heard of you. You're in the local seminary, and you're a convert from another church, another body. So," she said, "come in, and I'll get the sister who deals with vestments to measure you." So I went into the room just adjoining the chapel, and a young nun came in with the Mother Superior. And the nun had to reach through the bars to measure me with the tape. She measured me around the waist and across the hair in various places. And she told me to come back on a certain day for a fitting. And then I talked for a few moments with the Mother Superior, who was a delightful woman. And I went away. The second time I went, the Mother Superior asked me, she greeted me at the door. She said, Father, you've had an unusual experience being converted from Anglicanism to Roman Catholicism. Will you come one night this week and talk to my nuns and tell them all about your conversion and why you became a Roman Catholic? And tell them something about the Anglican Church, because we Spaniards know nothing about any form of Protestantism. Most of us have never even seen Protestants, being a solidly Catholic country. So I went back one night that week, and I sat on the outside of the bars. The nuns were all, I think, there were 35 or 36 of them, sat on the other side, on little stools. And I talked to them for about half an hour. And then they kept me there for about an hour and a half answering questions. So it was a very interesting little evening for me. I opened it. And I continually, every time I went there, I admired this Mother Superior. She seemed such a wonderful woman. I later learned that if she had not gone into a convent, she would have been a duchess in her own right. But that doesn't make a difference in the kingdom of God. There aren't any duchesses up there. So then I went back for my final, you get the vestments. And the Mother Superior delivered them to me. And she said, Father, do you see that statue of Our Lady over there by the chapel entrance? That is a very old statue. And on this street, a few doors down, Christopher Columbus used to live. And for several months before he went out to discover America, he came almost every morning to this chapel to Mass. And when Mass was over, he knelt down there and prayed. So with timidity, I went over there after I'd taken my leave from the mother. And I knelt down where Christopher Columbus had once knelt. And I said to myself, this is where America began, right here in this spot. Because I'm sure, in those months before he set out on the stormy seas, that Columbus prayed for her protection, her guidance, her help, her succor. And Mary Immaculate guided him to America. And then there were several other little significant facts that seemed to me to all to add up to this thesis of mine, that Mary was behind it all. The ship that Columbus sailed on himself, there were three ships. But the flagship on which he sailed was called the Santa Maria, Holy Mary. She was with him. He was a great Catholic. He was born in Genoa, in Italy, but he was in the service of the King and Queen of Spain. And he had behind him that lovely saintly woman, Isabella. And then, on the journey out on those stormy seas, every evening, as the sun was going down, Columbus called all of his crew on board, and they sang the Salve Regina, Hail Holy. And then finally, when they sighted land and went ashore, it was the 12th of October, and that day is a Marian festival, the day of Our Lady of the Pillar, the Nuestra Señora del Pilar. It all adds up, Christian. I believe with all my heart that the Holy Mother of God was behind this great festival, that she guided Columbus here, and that she guided the church. This life. After Columbus's voyage of discovery, he thought he was going to India, you know, because in 1453, Constantinople had fallen from Christian hands into the hands of the Mohammedans. And that closed the trade routes to the east. And after the Crusades, the people of Europe had got used to all sorts of luxuries from the east. Silk from China, spices from India, and so on. And so Columbus set out to discover a new route to India, but he found America instead. He found this blessed land, this blessed country. And he found it with the aid of the Queen of Heaven. So after these voyages of discovery,
there from San Diego on the south to just north of San Francisco, they established 21 missions. Those missions, in either original form or reconstructed form, are still there. And each one of those missions was a center not only for the propagation of the Holy Faith, but also a center of civilization. They taught the Indians there how to rotate their crops, how to fertilize their soil. They even taught them Latin to a certain extent, so they could serve the Holy Mass. They became lights in the darkness of that coast. And from those missions spread out our Holy Faith. So the first settlers on this continent, in this land, were the Spanish Catholics. And they brought with them those simple Franciscan friars who propagated the Holy Faith and who taught the Indians to love their mother in heaven, the Holy Queen of Heaven. Some weeks ago, I said Mass for the first time in Tallahassee, in Florida. We've only recently started saying Mass there. And we have a little group there. And as I was driving over there from Jacksonville, to Tallahassee with the coordinator, he told me that the Spaniards in St. Augustine, the oldest city in the United States, now the United States, that they also had established missions like the ones in California. But unfortunately, just north of Florida was the English colony of Georgia, and that was a Protestant colony. And the English Protestants did not like the Spanish Catholics just south of them. So as soon as they would erect a mission down there, and gather the Indians into that mission, the colonists from Georgia would come down and raid them and destroy the mission. So the missions in Florida don't survive as those do in California. After the Spaniards came the French. They came up in the cold north. They sailed down the St. Lawrence River. They established themselves at Quebec, at Montreal, and other places along the route. And they too brought the Holy Faith. Because this was before the French Revolution, that Freemasonic plot that destroyed the faith in France. This was before that, and France was a Catholic nation, a Catholic land. And they brought their Holy Faith here. And with them came the Jesuit missionaries. And the Ursuline nuns. And they established missions all over the north. And the French Catholics penetrated out into the wilderness in every direction. The French discovered the Mississippi River. The first European to set eyes on Niagara Falls was a French priest. The French established a post, a trading post in Detroit, at Chicago, at St. Louis, at New Orleans, at Buffalo. And wherever they went, they took the Holy Faith. And wherever they went, they established love and devotion to Mary Immaculate. She was guiding them all. She was in this completely, the whole way. About 150 or 180 miles, I forget which, north of Toronto, at a place called Midland, Ontario, there was a large church on a hillside. And it was on that spot that several centuries ago, Jesuit martyrs were put to death. There were five of them put to death there, and two others over in what is now New York State. Those martyrs have been canonized. St. Isaac Job was one of them. St. Gabriel Lalma. St. Jean Brogroup. They were all canonized. And for the first time, martyrs' blood was shed on American soil. And the place where the martyrdom took place was a little fort dedicated the Mary Immaculate, Saint Marie des Hurons, the Mary of the Hurons. The Hurons were the tribe around in that area, and they were very friendly to the French. And the Jesuits had great success in converting them to the Holy Faith. But the Iroquois were the enemies of the Hurons, and therefore they were the enemies of the French and of the Holy Religion. And so they came in, and they were the ones who martyred the Jesuit priests, lay brothers. So again, our Blessed Lady showed her presence on American soil. Then came the English. Now in the Middle Ages, England was a solidly Catholic country. Blessed Lady. In fact, England was known in the Middle Ages as the dowry of men. But then a ruthless king and a ruthless government forced the people out of Catholicism into heretical Protestantism. The English did not want to become Protestant, but they had no recourse. They had no other way. There was no avoiding it. They were made to become Protestant. And it was done gradually. For a while, things looked Catholic in their churches. But gradually, it became Protestant. You know, you've been through it too, so long. 20 years ago, we went through that same thing. That is what happened in England 4 centuries ago. So when the English came here, they came as Protestants. And they brought with them the cruel laws against Roman Catholicism that they had in England. The penal laws. In England, it was against the law to say this mass that I'm saying here now. It was against the law to be what I am, a Roman Catholic priest on English soil. It was a Roman Catholic in England could not vote. He could not hold any civil office. If he did not go to the Protestant church on Sundays, he had to pay a fine. Those were very severe laws. And many, many martyrs suffered martyrdom in England in those days. Hundreds of them. Men, women, and even young children. They were put to death ruthlessly. The English martyrs. Quite a number of them have been canonized too. So those severe laws against Roman Catholicism were brought to this site. And those laws penetrated even into areas which had been converted to Catholicism by the Spaniards or the French. So Roman Catholicism began, after the English came, with every possible handicap. Those laws were especially severe in the southern colonies, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. Only in one colony, Maryland, was Roman Catholicism tolerated. Because Maryland was settled by Lord Baltimore and a little group of English Roman Catholics. So there was a bit of toleration there, which later was revoked. Pennsylvania had a certain amount of tolerance, because the Quakers, who were also a persecuted minority, were the ones who settled the state under William Penn. But even in New York, there were laws against Roman Catholicism. And of course in Massachusetts, you can imagine what the English Puritans thought of Roman Catholicism. So Roman Catholicism in the period of the 13 colonies had to suffer severely. And for all practical purposes, it was a persecuted minority outside of the law, outside of toleration. Then came the War of Independence. The War of Independence was fought in the name of freedom, and freedom came. But although freedom came, there was still bigotry. There was still a dislike and a suspicion of Roman Catholicism. Freemasons were very strong in the early governments, and they did not look with favor on the Roman Catholic Church. However, Mary was watching over it all. The Holy Queen of Heaven. And then, strange things began happening in Europe, in Christian Europe. Ireland, at the Reformation, was the only country of English speech which stayed Catholic. England and Scotland became bitterly crushed. Ireland, for the most part, remained Catholic. But it was the English Protestant government which governed in Ireland. And the Roman Catholic Mass was against the law. So the Catholics used to go out into the glens at night with flickering lanterns. At each end of the glen, they post a guard to keep watch for the English police, and Mass was celebrated secretly. So the flame of the faith was kept alive in Ireland. And then Ireland, which has always been a poor country, the soil there is not very good for crops, it's good for peat. There's too much rain there.
The only thing that would grow with any success much in Ireland is potatoes. Turnips, things like that. Then came the potato famines. And a large part of the Irish population were starving. And they heard of a land across the sea where they could be free, where their children would have an opportunity. And so the Irish started coming to America. They were very poor when they arrived here. They had no money in their pockets. The only kind of jobs they could get were very poor, ill-paid jobs. But they had one jewel of great price that they brought with them. And that was their holy faith. And their love of Mary and I. And so they came in their thousands. And they began building churches in this land. With their hard-earned pennies, they built churches and they built parochial schools. And so the church began to grow. One of the churches they built was a great church in what is now Fifth Avenue in New York City. And they dedicated it to the saint, the patron saint of their native land, St. Patrick's Cathedral. That was built with the pennies of Irishmen, hard-earned pennies. A few years ago, sacraments took place in that cathedral. Cardinal Cook, now the part of this life, held a service in there of all religions. Jewish rabbis were there chanting their Jewish prayer. Mohammedan imams were there chanting their Mohammedan prayer. Buddhists were there chanting, beating on drums. They were having their faith, their cult there. Hindus were there. All religions were represented. And Cardinal Cook sat up on his throne, and beside him sat the Dalai Lama of Tibet, who belonged to the most degraded form of Buddhism. This took place in this holy place built by Irish Catholics. What a horrible sight. Then after the Irish came the Germans. Germany at the Reformation, Martin Luther, of course, was a German. Germany was a country split between Protestantism and Roman Catholicism. Two-thirds of the country was Protestant, but one-third stayed Catholic. And so the Germans are before. Many of them Protestants, but also many of them Catholics. And they settled in this land. The Germans, like the Irish, were a very devout Catholic people. And they settled very largely in the Middle West. There are three cities in this country today that have a very strongly German background. One is Milwaukee. The Germans settled in Milwaukee in large numbers. And Milwaukee is famous not only for its beer, which is good, but also for its beautiful churches built by German Catholics. It's a city of magnificent churches. And then the Germans settled in St. Louis on the Mississippi River. And that became a great Catholic city. Chiefly of German Catholics, but finally of all Catholics of all times. And the other city was Cincinnati. A city of very strong German background and German Catholic background. So the Germans came, and they built up the church too. And after the Germans came the Italians. They came from the very heart of the Roman Catholic faith. From the land of Rome itself. They came in large numbers to this country, and they established all over the land Italian parishes. Dedicated very largely to St. Francis of Assisi and St. Anthony of Padua. And they brought, too, the richness of their faith, their treasures. And then came other Catholic races. The Poles came, and the Lithuanians. And that part of Europe has always been very Catholic. Because on one side of it, it had Orthodox Russia, now Communist Russia. And on the other side, Protestant Germany, now Protestant East Germany. and Poland and all the Baltic states have suffered terribly through history because they've had these two races on either side of them coming at them, invading them, taking them over. But they came in large numbers. And of course, Poland has always had its heart in the shrine of Our Lady of Czestochowa. That great monastery in the middle of Poland has kept Poland alive more than anything else. Today, all that part of Europe is in ruthless communist hands. Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. But there, Our Lady of Czestochowa is still the beating heart of Poland. They settled very largely in certain cities in this country, have a very Polish flavor about them. Detroit, Chicago, Buffalo. And so the church grew up in this land through immigration. But not only immigration. Americans of all types, Protestants, non-believers, began studying the credentials of the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. And they discovered that Roman Catholicism was a religion of common sense. That's why Protestants become Catholics. That's why I became Catholic. That was the only logical religion there is. Roman Catholicism goes from A to B, from B to C, from C to D. It's all logical. It's common sense. And it seems to me that nobody can study the credentials of the Roman Catholic Church without becoming one. And so converts began pouring into the church. Many of them in this land were very eminent converts, statesmen. There's even a theory, some people believe, I don't know if there's any truth in it, not that George Washington wrote his death, they became Catholic. You probably heard it, I don't know. Nobody can prove that he did or that he didn't. But statesmen became Roman Catholics. Lawyers, doctors, professors. They poured into the church. The church was growing. And the church became strong. But still, there was victory in the land. Prejudice against Roman Catholicism. It always seemed to persist. But it is like the Ku Klux Klan were out, stirring up prejudice. There were certain groups all over the country, fundamentalist Protestants and others, who were always pouring calumny on the Roman Catholic Church. In 1928, Alfred Smith, the then governor of New York, a Roman Catholic, was nominated as the presidential candidate from the Democratic Party. And immediately the propaganda bill started. Rumors began spreading over the country, propagated very often by clergy, Protestant clergy. I remember there was a rumor at that time that a cable, an undersea cable, was being constructed from the White House in Washington to the Vatican in Rome. So the President of the United States, every morning after breakfast, would get his orders from the Pope. All over the South, particularly, billboards were put up, great hoardings, with unbelievable pictures on, pictures of Roman Catholic priests in hazards and owls and berettas, bandaging babies, that sort of thing. It's unbelievable that the wrong thing could have happened in this land. But it did happen. But despite persecution, despite all of them, the church flourished. And the chief reason I think it flourished was because the church knew that children must have Catholic education. And this land was the land par excellence of Catholic education. Wherever there was a Roman Catholic church, there was a Catholic school next to it, a parochial school. The children were taught the Baltimore Catechism, which is the true, authentic Roman Catholic faith. Schools were established everywhere. The Catholic schools of America became the envy of the world. And not only primary and elementary education, Catholic high schools grew up everywhere, and Catholic universities. The land was dotted with great Catholic universities, many of them run by the Jesuits. There was quarter in New York. There was Georgetown in Washington. There was Notre Dame, run by another order in Indiana, the famous Notre Dame of the football. Then there was St. Louis University, Marquette University, various universities dedicated to St. Ignatius Loyola. Universities spread across the land. The Catholic University of Washington. So Catholic education was strong. And the church not only had tremendous spiritual force in this country, it had tremendous moral force. About 60 years ago, I suppose it was, Hollywood began getting dirty. If you compare the dirt then with the dirt now, the dirt then seemed very hard compared to what it is now. But still it was dirty. So the Roman Catholic Church in this land organized a legion of decency. And it served notice on Hollywood. Clean up the act. Or else. I believe that the Roman Catholic Church a few years ago had still had moral force in this country, we wouldn't have this horrible, ghastly thing of abortion. But that came in largely because the Roman Catholic Church had given up. So the church gained moral force in this country. And it really began to look as though this country might become Catholic. One of the great leaders produced in this country by the Catholic Church was Cardinal Spellman from New York. He was a great Catholic. And he was a great American. He went for, I don't know how many years, every Christmas to Vietnam. And celebrated Mass after the troops. Stayed with them over Christmas. Had his Christmas dinner. I only saw him once. And that was in Rome some years ago. He'd taken a pilgrimage to Fatima and then on to Rome. And I saw him marching down the street in Rome to the American Church of Santa Susanna, which is the American Church in Rome. And in front of him was a cross and beside it was stars and stripes. And Cardinal Spellman was walking along proudly in his cardinal's robes. Behind him he had about 50 or 60 pilgrims. He taken the cross. He was a great man. And he began feeling, in that period, when he was Archbishop of New York, that in the end, the Roman Catholic Church in this country was going to win. And that there would be a Catholic America. Not next week, not even next month, or next year, or in the next decade, perhaps. But he could see over there a rosy dawn. And he could see the possibility of a great Catholic America. And so the church in this country was at the height of its power and influence. It was strong. People began everywhere respecting it. It was the chief religious body in this land. And so when it was at the very height of its power and influence in this country, what did the church do? I'll tell you what it did. It committed suicide. It committed suicide. Can you imagine? It cut its own throat. It drained the lifeblood out of its body. And that is the most hideous tragedy that has ever taken place. Because it took place not only in America, but all over the world. The Roman Catholic Church gave up the fight. When it was right up on the top of the hill. When the prospect, when you could look over and see the promised land of a Catholic America. It gave up the fight. It decided that it wanted to be ecumenical. They didn't want to be modern. They didn't want to be up to date. They didn't want it to be popular. They wanted to have the approval of the Protestants, the Freemasons, the Communists, the Jews. And so it gave up. It's your friend. water. When there's a shipwreck, there are little lifeboats. And some people have the sense to get in them and get away from the sinking ship. That happened when the Titanic went down, when the Lycus Penia went down. And so from the shipwreck of the Roman Catholic Church, little lifeboats went out. Those were our lifeboats. We were in them. And so the Roman Catholic Church still exists. No longer is it the great, powerful, wealthy body that it was. Now it's confined to little groups here and there, spread around the world. But it has the true faith. It has the true liturgy. And it has Mary Immaculate, the Queen of Heaven, in the boat. She's with us. The great body of the church is now a cancerous, sick organism, running away with its dancing nuns, its heretical priests, its bogus liturgy, its clown masses, its stupidities, its apishness. It's finished. It's no longer the Roman Catholic Church. Who can look at it and see anything about it that's Roman Catholic authentic? Its bishops waste their time, its so-called bishops waste their time, frittering away on adopting silly resolutions about disarmament, unilateral disarmament for this land, or socialistic pronouncements about the economy. Its priests waste their time in deforming further the already hideous liturgy that they have. I know there are some good people up there. I know there's still some good Catholics there who love Our Lady, who love the Sacred Heart, who love the Mass. But they've been hoodwinked. Somehow they still kept their Catholic heart, but they're dying off rapidly. So here we are. It all began there when Columbus knelt down in that convent in Seville and prayed. Here we are today. However, she's still with us. And if she's there, I for one am not going to get there. She'll see us. I must admit that sometimes I get a little depressed. We seem such a small body. But then I remember, she's there. She'll see us through. She'll never fail me. She never failed me, I know that. She led me into the Catholic Church, she had to pull me by the nose almost. But she got me there. And she'll get us. Again, so that we're on the top of the hill. It may be centuries off, I don't know. But it's all in her hands. And that's the story. And I want to tell you on this New Year's Day, which you already know, looking back, because we have to look back before we can look forward. So we look back over the history of this great and lovely land. To its beginnings in the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And there in the future, again, Mary Immaculate.